This is Chris Evans with the Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm joined by two guests for the end of the year show. I'm going to say the end of our year, but I suppose it's the end of everybody's year, isn't it, guys? It's Chris Miller and Martin Glasbrow.
And hello to you.
Hey, Chris.
Do you know, it sounds like there should have been some sort of applause in the background there. I need a little, like one of these buttons where I can press something and you get a little bit of applause in the background, like they use at the football matches now.
Just don't press the derisory laughter button at the wrong time.
I think
Chris had already pressed the disaster button earlier in the year, to be honest. That's why we're in
the pandemic
at the moment.
Yeah.
It's his fault. You've been to China recently.
No. I apologise to everybody, but it wasn't me. I didn't have anything to do with it. I've not been to China ever, actually, funny enough. It was on the list, but I'm not sure it's on the list anymore. We're going to be a few years before we're all travelling again, but maybe it'll come back on the list again. Anyway, enough of that frivolity. We're here to record, well, probably this will probably end up as a two-parter, but we're here to record an end-of-the-year show to talk about what went on in 2020 and to try at least and avoid as much as possible the whole COVID discussions. But I'm sure we'll have to talk about it at some point and try and see what we think happened and look back at what we projected at the beginning of the year to see how accurate we were.
And do it over a beer.
Yeah, and do it over a beer. So, Chris, you're on a health kick?
I am. I'm on a personal reduce my occupied space kick.
Right. So you haven't got a beer. Martin and I are both drinking classic Christmas. Is it just called Christmas Ale from Shepherd Neame?
From Shepherd Neame, mm-hmm. Where my great-grandfather used to live on the farm at one point, which supplied hops to Shepherd Neame. So I have a family connection with the brewery.
Fantastic.
Good.
Do you get any freebies because of that?
Pardon? No, I don't get any freebies for it.
Oh. I'd love to say we were sponsored by Shepherd Neame, but we're not.
Yeah, literally, they can do if they want.
Yeah, absolutely. Very happy for us to sample one of their beers every week, if that's what they'd like us to do, you know, send us freebies. But we're not sponsored by them. We've just decided it'd be nice to sit here and have a Christmas drink. Mm. Because we're having to do this virtually, of course, like all of our podcasts at the moment, like everything else, because we're still technically in the edge of lockdown. And maybe that's a good place to start, really, and just, you know, just reflect on what a weird year it's been in general, and what a weird year it's been both for the industry and from a COVID perspective, and how it's had such an effect on us.
Well, one of the oddest effects of the pandemic has been that nobody's hired a Gartner analyst. This is personally shocking to me after Rubrik's foray last year, hiring three of them and a few others.
That's true. Good point. But then again, didn't Gartner make an awful lot of money from events, and therefore maybe they're a bit short in the wallet this year?
Well, there could be layoffs then. We could have some new Gartner analyst recruitment news early in the new year.
Yeah. Well, that's something we should perhaps reflect on and move on before we get ourselves into a bit of trouble. But in general, though, I mean, Martin, you know, it's not been a great year, but we did podcast a couple of times earlier in the year, and we talked about what we thought would happen with, you know, the virus. And I just wonder, when we look back at that, do you think we were about right? Do you think we were too naive? Do you think we're too pessimistic? I think we probably got it about right, really.
About right. I think we were probably a little bit pessimistic on some stuff and a little bit naive on other. It's been an interesting year, and I think it'll be the end of year figures for people will be very interested to see what the shipments are like for storage. I can see you, but you can't see it, but I can see Mr. Miller raising his eyebrows at this. Obviously, in business, a lot of projects have gone on hold, but I don't see it as slowed as much as some people think. And I think that the hot thing for a lot of people has been cloud.
I think there have been two disappointments in the year. All flash arrays, I think. How to put this? Pure Storage has had three quarters of no or flat growth. This is astonishing considering its rate beforehand. And it thinks the next quarter is not going to be that good either. And PowerStore, Dell EMC's latest all-flash array, hasn't taken off that well, with Jeff Clark in the latest earnings call saying that he and his management team are impatient for it to grow. But it is an early release. It is early on the market. It's not growing fast. It just seems to me it's not picked up from Unity at all, or not well enough.
Does that say to you, from, say, Pure's perspective, that perhaps they're managing to get repeat business from existing customers who have hardware and who don't have to go through a POC or have to be, I guess, recruited to being a customer, whereas finding new customers is a lot harder because they can't do the face-to-face side of things.
No, they can't. The salespeople aren't going out. I think there's been quite a change in focus from outside sales to inside sales, with some companies laying off outside salespeople more or less totally.
I would tend to agree. I mean, I think it's much, much harder for people who aren't incumbent to turn up to sell to people like myself. You can't get a face-to-face meeting. Doing it all over Zoom or Teams or WebEx, it's not the same. People do buy from people, but it's that old adage. And yeah, I do think it's much, much harder. Weirdly enough, I also think that's impacted PowerStore. PowerStore has been very hard for EMC to get their TCs out to talk to people, to actually talk about. So people are, from that point of view, for their on-premises stuff, I think a lot of people are sticking with what they know.
I did put them in my Turkey of the Year award section, but maybe that's been a bit harsh. Maybe, you know, that the product might have been more successful had we not been in the middle of a pandemic. It may well have seen a lot more growth.
I also think they suffer from a thing, and we've talked about this a bit. PowerStore doesn't half feel a bit like Unity. So I think there's a crossover at the moment. Trying to think of the unique selling point of PowerStore in a year when you want to de-risk, you're not going to transition to a new product. So if you're a Unity customer, you're going to be a Unity customer. And I can't see anybody, and I can't see them going after, say, a NetApp or whoever else's estate. That's just not going to happen at the moment.
Maybe they should have just used the tagline, PowerStore, it's a bit like Unity. And then that would have get them some sales, because people would have been, oh, it's a bit like what we already know, so that's fine, we could use it.
Well, maybe an idea, they could have called it Clarion.
Yeah, gone backwards.
Hey guys, don't give up the day jobs.
Has anybody ever done that, do you think? Gone backwards with a product name and gone used, like, reverted the trend of the product names. That'd be quite fun. So from our point of view, Chris, you and I, what about conferences? I mean, the conference, we used to be out, every week at conferences.
It's getting, we used to moan about going to conferences, yeah, didn't we? Gosh, how I miss them. How I miss the face-to-face, the seeing changes in people's expressions when things are said or when they hear things.
Yeah.
Handshakes and just the simple informality of it all. Being able to pick up so much nuances from people in a group which are just gone in a Zoom session. Oh dear, I really want to go back to Las Vegas, please.
Do you know what I would have said? That would have been, said nobody, to add to that. But actually, I see what you mean. I'm not sure I'm in a rush to go back to Las Vegas particularly, bearing in mind how busy those casinos can be. But I do agree with you that there's just a massive amount of nuance of the face-to-face and everything else that goes with it that's completely gone.
So bad, Chris, interrupting you, that I even consider going to the Excel Center for a conference at this point in time.
Wow. That's commitment.
That's commitment.
That is commitment. I was just going to say, though, that I have no idea what I was going to say. Actually, I completely forgotten how you've interrupted me. But I was going to say something. Who knows? I was going to say something about the conferences, but you're right. Even Excel might even look attractive at this point, but I don't know whether that's entirely true. I guess what I was going to say was that ultimately, from my perspective, I've just decided I just can't do the online stuff. I just find them so boring. I don't like this idea of them trying to fake it so it looks like a scheduled event with things that are actually pre-recorded, but they want you to turn it at a certain time and all that nonsense and all this thing about things like locking you to how only like a certain number of people can attend a session. All that sort of stuff just doesn't need to happen. So I've gone back and looked at things afterwards, and I've been watching things almost like binge watching some of the sessions, like for instance from Flash Memory Summit. It's amazing how quickly you can go, not interested, move on. You know, you couldn't walk out the room and go into the next one as easily, whereas when you're binge watching them, you can do it quite quickly.
I'm a bit disappointed they haven't got the speed up mode on the playback, so you can say, you know what, that half an hour session, if I play it back at 1.5 times or two times, I'll get the same information. Yeah. And I won't waste quite so much. And then I might also get amused.
Yeah. And it would sometimes just be, as you said, the amusement factor would be fantastic.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. So all these sessions which are pre-recorded and then they try and fake the schedule, and you'll look at it and you'll see the same session. Then a lot of conferences have worked out the fact they're running a conference which is global, so I'll have the same session three times, one for the US, one for EMEA, and one for APAC. But they won't let you watch it on demand until they've shown it three times. So that you'd be said, well, you've already recorded it.
Yeah.
Just let me watch it when I want to watch it.
Absolutely, yeah. Agreed. Here's another thought, Chris, on how the vendors are going to cope with things going forward. They'll have had a year of us not turning up to anything, and maybe even another 6 months, or maybe 18 months. Could even be as long as 2 years with us not going to events, and we'll class that as 2020 and 2021. Do you think a lot of these vendors are going to look at it and go, why were we spending this money? What was the benefit to this? Have we seen any less traction in the areas we want? And is the only reason we've seen less traction because the salespeople can't go and knock on people's doors? And should we ever even bother doing these sort of events again?
My instinct is they will start conferences a lot because it gives customers an awful lot of good opportunities to touch the metal and actually see products, see desktops, see screens working with storage products, I think is quite important. It's also a little reward for people, for customers, isn't it? Come along to a conference, we'll pat you on the back, we'll give you a private session with the CEO or the CTO and so forth.
Yeah.
I think they'll come back.
But in terms of analysts and things, Martin, you know, pseudo-analysts, influencers, whatever you want to call them, I think there's a real risk that they'll just realise that maybe they weren't getting the benefit they thought they were.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think it's an interesting point of view that conferences are seen as a reward for customers. I've never really felt that. I've always thought as a customer, going to a conference, actually paying to attend a conference where the vendor tries to sell you stuff, is a really interesting approach to sales. Okay, you're going to charge me for you to try and sell to me. I always find it a bit odd. I do wonder if we might see smaller events. I wonder if we might see smaller local events. I still think there will be reticence for a lot of people to travel. I mean, I know Chris has just said he misses Las Vegas. I think he's probably I think Chris probably misses Las Vegas. He's missed a chance to play the tables. We all know that's what he does.
That's the reason.
Call me Mr. Chips.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you know, there's a good chance though that we won't be able to travel because we won't be able to get insurance until we've had a vaccine.
Ooh.
So I think the insurance companies will put a restriction on that says unless you've had a certified vaccine within this group of vaccines, then we will not insure you to travel. And I would not be travelling to America or most places without having some sort of insurance. I wouldn't travel anywhere outside the UK without insurance. So I think that could be an influencing factor on whether we see people travelling again.
I have a set of briefing sessions to go to in the US in June, July period. Flights being booked, but I guess they've been booked with movable vouchers.
Right.
So there's optimism.
That is optimism. It's still quite a way out, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's really going to depend how quickly the vaccine rolls out.
Okay, so in terms of, you know, summarising what we think has happened to the industry, it seems to be that everything's been powering on. We haven't seen that much change apart from sales have been affected for certain areas. And certainly more and more people have pushed towards using the cloud. And hopefully not US East 1, because I wasn't very happy yesterday, or the opposite over the weekend. And there was a bit of a problem, people not being able to hoover or turn their lights on and off and all that sort of important stuff.
I don't normally reveal very much about what goes on in my work, but I will say as that was happening, I was having a meeting with a vendor and we were talking about geo redundancy strategies and how you need to have one with a cloud provider. I just thought it was funny when I log on to Twitter and I find that the East One is down probably again, isn't it? Isn't that not the one which has this habit of being killed?
I'm fairly sure that US East One is the oldest one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it the first one?
Yeah,
I think it's a bit aging. It's got some stuff that needs absolutely to be replaced.
Yeah, I wouldn't put any of my workloads in there. It seems to be the one which gets blown up more often.
Mm. Oh, well, there you go. What can you do? I was interested, Chris. I had to put this little section in because I thought it might be interesting as a bit of a discussion point. And that was the whole idea of the fundraising that we've seen. Now, this I thought was fascinating because initially I thought, maybe companies have gone off to just build that war chest up a bit harder, a bit bigger, so they've got something to go after, you know, keeping tided over through winter. Maybe companies have got, you know, a few troubles, perhaps, and need to raise money for other reasons. And, you know, I'd be interested in your opinion. I picked three out there, but I'm quite happy for you to talk about however you like. But I just thought it was interesting to see that money was raised right at the very beginning of this in sort of February time, wasn't it?
The most visible one of survival funding or refunding was Actifio, which went through an undisclosed funding round.
Yes.
And had a brutal reverse stock split for its stock option holders, effectively rendering their shares worthless.
Yeah, that was terrible.
That was, it was, it must have been absolutely necessary. There was a lot of funding rounds. Zerto had 33 mil, Cohesity had 250 mil, Vast Data had 100 mil, Cumulo had 125 mil, Redis Labs had 100 mil. That's four triple digit funding rounds in the year. Soft Iron had 34 mil for its Ceph hyperdrive. Wasabi had 30 mil for its cloud storage. I don't think any of these were necessarily pandemic related, although possibly Wasabi might have been because of its cloud act, but all the others, it's still build up, look for the long term, and make a big company in the future.
Mm. So the rest of us would possibly call it Wasabi. I don't know, just in case anybody's wondering who you mean.
It's hot stuff, whatever you pronounce it.
Absolutely. But it is interesting that it didn't seem to stop the fundraising.
No.
And clearly investors thought it was well worth going out there and putting more money into certain companies.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a risky thing where you've got sales flat, so you can't really see what's getting traction at the moment. But it was interesting to see people like Zerto raising money. I mean, Zerto's basically DR.
Yep.
We are in the middle of a disaster, but it's not a disaster which requires disaster recovery or business continuity at the moment. But maybe it's the feeling is something like that has actually increased the thoughts of CEOs and C-levels about their DR strategy. Maybe we do need to do something. Zerto looks interesting.
Zerto's building its product set out, so it's moved downstream, so to speak, into normal data protection.
Yeah,
it's also flying the ransomware banner as well. So I think Zerto's addressable market has got a lot bigger, and that may have encouraged some of the funding to go into it.
Yeah, that's possible. I just wonder whether they've got a business that's actually sustainable, because it seems to be that they keep coming back to raise money, and I'm not sure what the end game is, like a number of companies where you think, what is the end game? How many more rounds can we go through before you have to admit that you need to get to a point where your business is profitable? And it seems to be that they keep coming back and they keep shrinking the company to try and get through, you know, the next round or to do whatever. And I'm not sure whether just coming back, raising more money each time is a great strategy.
Well, the dilution obviously keeps going up.
Yeah,
it gets worse and worse for those people who have stock or those who have options. It becomes less attractive for people to want to work for it. And you need to keep your best engineers in these companies. I'm not sure what impact it's having on some of them, whether they're thinking, you know, perhaps I'll leap to the next big startup and I'll give that one a go.
There was a little bit odd aspect to the Zerto's funding in that it wasn't classic venture capital round. It was 33 mil equity finance and $20 million worth of debt finance. So that sums up to $53 million altogether, which is a hefty chunk of change. But it's not a standard venture capital round, which got me thinking why, and I have no answer to that question.
Other than maybe the VCs didn't want to put that much money in. Okay, oh well. It doesn't seem to have stopped certain companies floating or, you know, moving to the stock market. Not thinking of the one that we'll come up and talk about in a minute in the hype section, but I was thinking of Datto as an example, because they IPO'd, didn't they?
Yeah.
They were public.
Have you heard of them, Martin, at all, Datto? Are they not your neck of the woods?
I've heard of them. I've never really looked at them.
SMB then, I guess, rather than enterprise.
Yeah, they were just an MS. I think they allowed you to be a reseller, didn't they, of their technology? So you could be basically back up to their cloud.
Yeah.
And they would sell it to resellers as well, so that they would be the hosting cloud for the data protection or backup environment.
A financial analyst at William Blair went very enthusiastic about Datto, saying that their model of selling through low-end MSPs was totally brilliant. They were absolutely beautifully positioned for the whole SMB market to move lock, stock and barrel their backup and other storage to the cloud. Buy Datto shares, he was saying. They're in the right place.
Wouldn't that be what Veeam are trying to do? They're very much into the SMB, 400,000 customers. Sorry, they're probably complain about the fact that we don't say they're enterprise, but you know, when you've got 400,000 customers, they're not enterprise. They can't be. There's not 400,000 enterprises who buy their software.
Yeah,
there's a percentage who do, but there's a huge percentage who are clearly SMB. And I would have thought Veeam would have been very hot on trying to move those people into a cloud model if they possibly can.
Could be right. The two things I've seen on Veeam have been a continued focus on enterprise, building off the SMB platform, I guess, and buying Karsten to get into containerized backup.
Yeah, absolutely. We should maybe that's a great transition, Chris, there to the acquisition section of the discussion we're going to have. You did have a list, actually, and I don't know how you want to go through it, whether you want to just literally plough through it one by one, or whether there's anything you want to highlight in terms of interest. But you're right. I mean, the idea of Veeam buying Kasten was interesting because they were partnered, weren't they, earlier in the year? They were actually working together. And then clearly Veeam is a massive gap in their portfolio for any sort of protection on containerized environments. And that was plugging it. And now that's now plugging it as a permanent sort of a permanent offering there.
Pure Storage bought Portworx containerized storage and containerized data protection. They spent $370 million on that. A lot of money. Also in the year, they cancelled their own object engine, which was backing up data from Pure Arrays into an object storage system and then punting it off to the cloud.
Yep.
And a month or two after canning object engine, they came up with this flash recover deal with Cohesity. So a Pure Flash Arrays has data sucked off it by a Cohesity appliance, which then squirts it off to the cloud. So Flash Recover replaces Object Engine, and Pure also buys Portworx, partly for containerized backup storage. So I think Pure is moving quite strongly into a sort of nearline data protection archiving situation with Flash in the cloud.
I just wanted to just go back to the Veeam Kasten discussion for a second or two. Because that whole idea of backing up containers and having some sort of solution for that sounds like something you absolutely should have in your portfolio. But Kasten and Veeam are under the same VC,
aren't they? Yeah, it was so possibly it was Insight Partners putting the two together.
So if you are acquired by a VC who also owns the company that you are being acquired by, so for instance, so let's think of this as a hierarchy. You've got the venture capitalist owns Veeam, also owns shares in Kasten, and then Kasten is bought by Veeam. What do you actually get as shares at that point for your purchase of your company? If the sale of your company is in a combination of stock and shares, do you get shares in the VC? Do you get shares in a company that isn't floated, as in Veeam? How do you sell those shares? How do you value those shares? It's not like, you know, when, say, if somebody like Dell or HPE buys you and they give you shares, those shares have got a pretty obvious nominal value that you can relate to. How do you do that in a situation like this? And was it just a bit of money swapping behind the scenes? I'm really interested to understand what, you know, actually went on.
I have no idea. Veeam was bought by private equity. I have no idea, Marty. My accounting skills are completely useless in this area.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Not that your accounting skills are complete useless, but the fact that these all looks very opaque.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting to see the term sheets and seeing what's actually really going on. Is it just an accountancy exercise to actually consolidate some assets? I don't know.
I don't think so. The Veeam CEO was very, very enthusiastic about the deal. He sees it as a huge, huge win. Sorry, the Kasten CEO. He sees it as a huge, huge win for Kasten. They get access to the entire Veeam customer base, and Veeam gets access to the Kasten technology and can integrate it into Veeam's own storage platform. And it also helps Veeam go into the public cloud. Good stuff, he was saying. Very, very good stuff.
I think I wouldn't disagree with that. You know, this being bought by somebody's a good deal. If you're being bought by a much bigger company, especially one that's got literally billions of turnover every year, that's a great thing. And, you know, or fair play to them to being acquired. I guess it's just that exit strategy doesn't seem to be the same as it would be if it was with other companies where, you know, you've been acquired by somebody like an HP or, you know, a Dell or whatever, or even Pure because they're listed as a public company. And your earnout might be to be with them for 12 months, 18 months, 3 years, or whatever it happens to be, after which you can sell whatever shares you were given and you earn those shares and an earnout over the time that you're retained with the company. And at the end of it, the final tranche vest and you get the last, and then you can sell them on the open market. What do you do when the company is owned by a VC and the shares of Veeam, for example, have no market value directly because they're not traded on the market? So what's your exit strategy for somebody
to sell the shares in Veeam that you've been given?
Yeah, to
whom? If you're a Kasten stock option holder, then presumably you now get Veeam shares.
Yeah.
And Veeam's clearly going to be heading for an IPO. I mean,
that's the only thing you can assume, isn't it? That at some point they're going to IPO and therefore your shares will be vastly more than they were when it was owned by the VCs.
So we just hope Veeam doesn't go through an Actifio scenario.
Absolutely.
There was another private equity buy, which was Panzura.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Collaborative file services and a cloud storage gateway with a focus on the engineering automation market. And Nasuni got a load of funding and is doing great things. And I think Panzura was a little bit left behind, so it's been taken out by private equity. Don't know who. Can't remember who bought it.
No, I must admit, I don't know either.
I'm not even sure why.
Well, and you know, that was my, I guess that's going to be my point. I guess I was going to raise, Martin, is that we've spoken with Andres Rodriguez number of times. We've spoken with Andy, who very kindly swore on the podcast when we told him not to, which was quite funny. And I think I even rang him back the following week by accident when we were recording with somebody else, when we used to use Skype to do our recordings. But the difference, I guess, between, say, Panzura and Nasuni, from what I can see, is Nasuni had built effectively what looked like an enterprise or an SMB filer that you could virtually or physically that you could put into an organization, and it did everything behind the scenes. Rather than it being a distributed file system, it was appliance-based, and I think as a consumer, very easy to understand, very easy to pick up and run with. And I wonder whether Panzura didn't have that simplicity model that made it a bit more difficult.
Panzura was certainly a lot more complex to deploy than Nasuni. Panzura really wasn't aimed at the SMB market, whereas I think Nasuni, but they know where they're playing.
Yeah.
It really is an SMB type environment. So if you're going for economies of scale, probably not really long sales cycles. It's almost something which you can turn up your credit card, sign up for, and off you go.
Well, I think you literally can. I think you literally can just use your credit card, download the virtual appliance, and you are off and running. I used it years ago, and it was really simple, really easy to use. And I think I have technically got an infinite forever license that if I go online now, I could download and use it again.
Have you got an infinite forever capacity, though, Chris?
I can't remember what it was. I think it was about 10 terabytes. I mean, it wasn't massive, but it was good enough to be, I mean, you could use it quite easily in a small business, but you know, a very, very easy to use solution. So, Chris,
it's funny, you're just sort of 10 terabytes, that's not a lot. And then you start thinking, actually, that is quite a lot, really.
Yeah, actually it is. Yeah, you're right. It's very easy to be very dismissive of the numbers nowadays and not realize that actually 10 terabytes is a huge amount. Yeah.
NVIDIA bought SwiftStack.
Which is
a little bit surprising. True. What's that got to do with GPUs?
NVIDIA are trying to turn themselves into an enterprise company, aren't they? They're very busily trying to work out how they become a data center company. They want to move away from, they want to move away from GPUs are sexy. They get to talk about them. Gets to wear a leather jacket and no socks on when he's presenting about them. So that's pretty cool. But enterprises are probably going to be less impressed with that. But yeah, I think they see SwiftStack and they can see that. NVIDIA in mass scale out compute. I think that's where I'm thinking SwiftStack would fall in for them. But NVIDIA wants to be a private cloud company. I think that's quite obvious.
And didn't NVIDIA actually use SwiftStack internally or something? And there was a talk about whether it was just done to sort of bolster an environment that they used and were reliant on, didn't want to lose it. So that by bringing it in-house, that was a benefit.
Well, perhaps it was cheaper for them to buy them and actually pay the licensing fees.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, pretty much.
VMware bought Datrium.
Yep.
So there was another disaster recovery company.
Yep.
But it also had its distributed or disaggregated HCI products as well. And they promptly got tossed on the scrap heap. So
which
I think
is,
it's just the DR bit that's surviving inside VMware.
I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. And there was actually, do you know, you've listed other things. And was IBM buying Red Hat into 2020? Was it 2020?
I think it was last year.
Was it complete
in 2019, I think. Did Red Hat really buy IBM? Who knows?
NetApp bought a couple of companies. Spot, which does price breaking on cloud services. So you can get a cheap cloud service through using Spot. And it also bought Cloud Jumper for VDI from the cloud. It canned its NKS product, which was basically build our own Kubernetes distribution.
Yeah.
Fired up a Project Astra, so it could use everybody else's Kubernetes distributions with some services on top of them. And it now says it's becoming a cloud-led, data-centric global company.
Mm.
So how about that? No more hardware arrays for us.
So, you know how Marathon is or was marketed as a Snickers in America?
Yes.
Is Cloud Jumper Cloud Sweater in America?
You're just trying to pull one over, aren't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, they did do some interesting acquisitions. And their NKS was a bit interesting that they went down that route. And then I think they realised, well, we can't compete and we need to use somebody else's, which is fair enough. But I still haven't got my head around the VDI one. And I did have a analyst meeting where they tried to explain it a bit. And I sort of can see where they're going with it. But I think we talked about this earlier in the year, or a couple of weeks ago, Martin. It was seemed to be a bit more of an opportunistic, perhaps, acquisition that fits the market the way it is this year.
I just think it's a Currian Brothers. I think Currian said, Currian, no, you haven't got a cloud strategy. I mean, after all, watch us, we're going to buy a load of people.
Do you reckon it was a brotherly discussion one day over the family dinner table?
Yeah. Do you think George possibly had a talk with the Doubting Thomas? Was that it?
Yeah, he might have done.
He could well have done, yeah.
Or his mum said, being as if they rolled his mum out at the NetApp conference, his mum said, you know what? You need to buy the cloud company like your brother.
Yeah, you need to step up. You're not doing well enough. Buy some cloud companies. Mm. Oh, you never know.
How about the oddest thing of the year, which was Stellus, which came out and announced this absolutely marvellous key value store all flash array.
Mm.
When it was bankrolled through its development by Samsung. And 2 or 3 months after it announced the product, the chief revenue officer of the company split.
Yeah.
So he obviously knew something we didn't know.
Yeah. Do you know what? You jumped ahead again into my section that says this year we said goodbye to. You killed three of them in that list, or four of them in that list already. We'll have to come back to it in a minute.
But no discipline.
Yeah. Absolutely. We'll come back to that in a second. But you're right, Stellus. I thought Stellus was interesting, and I'll tell you the reason why. It seemed like they had some interesting technology, and they presented it at a tech field day. They did an hour at a tech field day. And I asked the usual questions, and I think this was the last face-to-face event we did, so it would have been probably January. And at the time, they were saying, oh, we're recording it, we'll publish it later. I'm not sure whether it ever got published, whether it ever did get released. And I didn't talk about it for ages because there wasn't the video to reference.
Hmm.
And some of the questions that we asked, we were looking at it thinking, yeah, this tech seems to be okay. The idea seems to be there if the key value drives really take off. But as you said, then all of a sudden it just seemed to get, taken out behind the woodsheds and the old bolt gun in the back of the head and that's the end of
decapitated.
That. And, yeah. But I wonder whether, is this because it was... Samsung, and have they veered away from the Ethernet drives or realized that they may not be as successful as they thought? Maybe that's part of this. Maybe it was just they were too closely aligned to Samsung in the first place.
Or maybe it was a whiptail.
Or it never actually worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, oh gosh, I'm trying to be very careful here. I think whiptail did work, but it did have issues and it didn't really...
It didn't scale, did it? Yeah. Cast its eyes over it, they thought, we've got to make so many changes to make this thing scale. And then they threw up their hands in horror. Oh, it's not written according to the way we write our software. Oh, it doesn't do this. Oh, it doesn't do that. So they threw their hands up and walked away.
Mm. It was really bizarre to be at a presentation that never got published, and we spent weeks and weeks saying, when's it going to go up online? When's it going to go up online? And I think then they were going to do a follow-up, and then they never did, and then that was the end of that. But we'll come back and we'll talk about some of those others in a minute. I think I'd like to end our first part, part one we'll call this. I'd like to end up part one and talking about hype of the year. What technologies do we think have been over-promoted? Now, I came up with my little list. And my list is DNA storage, the Snowflake IPO, optical drives again, SmartNICs, and possibly every DR product on the planet suddenly now being perfectly practical and usable for ransomware. So suddenly everybody had done that. Now, is that a reasonable list, or are there any others I could have added to that?
I'm going to throw one in which is probably going to be a bit controversial. Container storage.
Ooh.
It certainly got well hyped, didn't it? Name a company that didn't have a container storage action sometime in the year.
And I'm still not convinced container storage is anything special.
Mm. Okay.
I think you can do most container storage with standard persistent volumes anyway. I've not seen anybody thought, oh. Well, that changes the way you deploy and use containers.
Yes, I can see entirely why you're saying that, Martin. And I think the jury is probably out, because there is, I would say that there's a division there in the way that solutions are implemented. So there's a benefit in having storage connected to a container that's got more of an understanding of the container's requirements. So you maybe can align things to the container a bit more accurately. And that might be around QoS, or it might be resiliency or other things. But I'm not sure whether the long-term strategy for persistence and keeping all of that data will be to build servers from bare metal that you then put disks into and run it like HCI. I think ultimately there'll be a combination of traditional shared storage, where the increased resiliency is, and the access point becomes the container storage. And as an example, and this is not particularly aimed at highlighting a clever strategy from Purit, just as that's what they've done so far. They could potentially, for example, use Portworx as the application interface layer into the container environment, yet still store the data and do all the clever stuff on the physical infrastructure that sits below that, including optimization. And I wonder whether actually the solution going forward for all of this will be a hybrid of the two. It doesn't mean that other companies like, say, StorageOS or Maya Data, OpenEBS, couldn't compete in this market, but either I think they'll get acquired by somebody else who'll integrate it, or they'll end up being some sort of other interfaces that open up that allow us to do more.
I was just going to say, I mean, I just think it's overhyped at the moment, so I don't think any of them are anywhere near ready.
And I think actually, you're right that it is overhyped at the moment, yes.
Yeah, and I think you look at where we still are with things like Kubernetes and things like that, it's still shifting so fast that means that putting a bet on a container storage platform at the moment is a fairly high risk investment for any enterprise to start with. You might be better off just sticking with what you've got and using persistent volumes in the way you want it until you really know exactly what you're doing. And then you may think, you know what, this is all cloud native anyway. I'm just going to hive it off into public cloud anyway.
Absolutely. What about smart NICs? I mean, you know, you can't move without somebody having their own smart NIC solution these days.
I think these have got legs. I think they've got very, very strong legs. I think the whole idea of data processing units, which smart NICs are an example of, is another thing that's going to have strong legs. And I think 2021 will see quite a bit of progress in this area. The whole of NVIDIA's Mellanox Bluefield technology are all about smart NICs. VMware's thoroughly excited about them. Sticking vSphere on a Bluefield smart NIC, having the thing run storage. Nebulon uses effectively a smart NIC to run its storage drives in the server that hosts its card. NVIDIA wants to get into that market. NVIDIA wants to have a chat with external storage array suppliers and say, you can use smart NICs to offload Xeon processors. Well, your storage controllers, they're Xeon processors, aren't they? Suppose we do your dedupe, your compression, your packet framework processing, all that networky stuff on our smart NIC, then your Xeon storage controllers, well, they don't have to do so much, so they could do more of their main job. You can also use fewer cores. You could also even think about recompiling your storage controller code and running it on a pair of our Bluefields, says Jensen with no socks and a leather jacket.
Yeah, his leather jacket. What do you think, Martin?
I don't think it's 21. I think it's further out than that. Well, I think we've looked at it and thought, you know what, but it's interesting. And seeing where they go. I think there was actually another interesting acquisition which may play into this as well. AMD's buying Xilinx is quite an interesting one as well.
The Alveos, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, are they overhyped? Certainly, I think it's like container storage. It's still too early. I don't think we're going to see anybody deploying them at scale for some time.
Mm-hmm.
It feels only appropriate to enterprise and hyperscalers. It's not something which they're going to ship to mom and pops.
Fungible, the chip, the data processing unit chip, they brought out the version for the storage controller. They'll be bringing out another version for a server so the two can then get together over a fungible fabric. So that's another part of the DPU hype that's going on. I don't think it's quite so frenetic as it is with container storage. And we don't have companies yet spending 370 million, well, like NetApp spending 300 million plus to buy one of these DPU companies. But I think the ground's been put in place.
Well, the thing about DPUs is it's hardware.
Lovely stuff. We love to touch hardware. I want to go to a conference and see them.
Yeah, but hardware is hard. And that's what. So pivoting, if you've gone through a hardware development, is much harder. If you've got a software, you decide you've gone down the wrong route, you can actually pivot much, much quicker and much easier. And the other thing for all these companies, for the smart NIC companies, every single one of them are going to have to make alliances with server vendors.
Yeah.
And there aren't very many server vendors left.
And that's Nebulon's problem, isn't it? They've signed up Supermicro, they've signed up HPE. It's possibly going to be another one, but we don't know who yet. And after that, Dell? And that's it. What about composable systems? Is that another growing hype area?
I think it could be. Can I go back slightly to the SmartNix one and give you my opinion, then we'll talk about composable.
Get back on track, Chris.
Two things I think are a challenge here. The first one is anything that's a bit of a computational storage unit type solution, I still think there's challenges with that technology. And the reason I say that is that if you put something like an HCI solution together where you put disks into a server, then those disks aren't necessarily just going to run standalone. They're going to be running RAID or they're going to have other things on them. So they're only going to have fragments of that data on there. And the security challenges around putting something in where you pull disks in and out, where you could put something on that drive, which is potentially nefarious, put it into a chassis and, you know, off you go corrupting data around a system. So I think the use cases and the implementation of composable, other than the obvious demonstrated solutions, I still think need to be worked out. That's one of them. Sorry, computational storage. The other one is, I think, if you look at, say, the offload engines seem pretty good to offload functionality from the core compute environment, and that could be really useful. Question is, what happens when we get Ethernet NVMe? So I don't know whether you saw this from Flash Memory Summit, Chris, but there was a presentation by Marvell where they were showing their Ethernet NVMe drives, which, if they're going to work better than the original Ethernet drives are, as in, you know, they've got the NVMe controller and everything built into the drive, they potentially could be the sort of thing that Vast Data is doing with, you know, their distributed NVMe drives and Optane. And perhaps that could actually be a very interesting area where that could really work, and you build out hyperscalable environments that are very cloud-like. But the control piece is going to be the hardest piece, and that's perhaps where, say, Nebulon might be in that game a little bit ahead of everybody to having thought through the management side, but not yet have the product which has got the feature set on it. You know, they've thought a lot more about that management aspect. So I think there's still some real potential to come from that. But, you know, like we said, it's another 2021, 2022, maybe even later time frame before we see something useful from it.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's less hyped, far less hyped than container storage. But there's a groundswell and it's perceptible that, and it's growing, I think. Mm. We'll be seeing more of it next year.
Yes. So should we call that end of part one?
Yeah, we'll call that end of part one, then we'll do part two.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.